So these are the stories that you need to know about today. Watch.
Emergency of the energy sector, the supply of energy, and the prices of energy.
This is the island they want to take.
Yeah.
The Marines aren't even going to get here before they all...
Yeah, this is, we're going to have all of those, and also we're going to have a conversation with a guest that they call Nostradamus, the Nostradamus of China. Jiang Chuqin is going to be joining us here to talk about what's going to happen. Remember, he makes predictions, and he's usually right, right? He's going to be predicting what's going to happen in the future because of what's going on right now there in the Gulf with China. What's going to happen with Russia? What's going to happen with the United States, with Europe, Asia, all of it on the Sanchez effect? Let's do this. By the way, I should mention that our guest has recently been on with Tucker, and he's been on ABC, and he's all over the place. So it's really nice that we're going to be able to be joined by him in just a little bit. So hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's get things started. Welcome to The Effect. Donald Trump's approval numbers are way down, 36%. So that means only about a third of Americans think that he's doing a good job as president. A third. Think about that. Sometimes it's good to be simplistic with these things. And more importantly, it means two-thirds of Americans then don't think he's doing a good job at all. And it also means that Mr. Trump is now officially as disliked as President Biden was. This keeps happening with American presidents. There is a consolation. He's doing better than European leaders. He's doing better than Macron. In France, he's doing better than Starmer. Doing better than Merz in Germany, right? Way better, as a matter of fact. They're way below. And I should tell you this, too, because I think this is good for reference. Mr. Trump began his presidency around 50%, around 47 to be exact. But somewhere around 50% of the people in the United States were okay with him and thought he was going to be a good president and approved of him as president at the time. So what's pushed him down these, what, 11 points, right? 47 to 36? Well, Americans don't believe that this war in Iran is being fought for them. And what they sense is that the United States is already losing, or certainly not achieving its goal of a, quote, quick victory, which is what they were told. So President Trump, look, President Trump is not in a good place right now, and he knows that. So what does he do? What does he do? Does he back away from this mess that he's created? And, you know, I mean that. He's created in the Persian Gulf. And does he admit that this isn't working and is not going well and hope that somehow he can talk to Iran and they can acquiesce? Or does he charge forward? Just, you know what? No, the hell with it. Full steam ahead. And let's escalate this war. Here's where the rubber meets the road. My sources, people that I have spoken to, and the information that I have used to prepare this report for you today, as I bring you this information, tells me it's the latter, not the former. In other words, he's charging ahead. I am learning, we are learning, that thousands of U.S. troops, most of them special forces, are already deployed and are going to be arriving in the Gulf this weekend, most likely ready to go. So let me take you through why I'm saying this and what my sources are telling me and what I have been told from people that I very much trust, some of which will remain anonymous, which leads me to believe to this conclusion that sometime after the market closes on Friday, after the market closes, the President of the United States will announce that U.S. forces are going to begin an operation or will have already begun that operation in the Gulf against Iran. So let me take you why I'm coming to this conclusion. First, and this is important, if you know the president, you know that this is a little weird. The president, Mr. Trump, this weekend was supposed to appear at a fundraiser in Mar-a-Lago. And he was going to be speaking at this conservative conference in DT, in Washington, D.C., CPAC, where he goes every year. That appearance has been canceled, right? So he's canceling a fundraiser in Mar-a-Lago. He's canceling a speech he was going to give at CPAC, this conference in D.C. These are two things he usually doesn't like to do. The president loves fundraisers, and always has gone to CPAC. Why is he all of a sudden canceling both of those things this weekend? Ask yourself. The expectation is that he's going to make some sort of announcement after the market closes on Friday. Now, since March 12th, according to sources with direct knowledge, a total of 35, count them, 35 C-17 cargo planes. That's like the old C-130, those big, giant cargo planes where you can get all kinds of stuff and they go overseas. They're big tanks, really. They have been taking off from the United States, from bases in Georgia, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Fort Bragg, California, among others. Yeah, here's a political story that talks about the fact that 3,000 troops are headed to the Middle East. But what they don't tell you are the specifics of where they're coming from, how many are actually there. My sources are telling me that these 35 cargo ships, planes, are carrying approximately 105 troops. Do the math. You know, 17 times 105, you're pretty close, somewhere between around 3,500 U.S. soldiers and Marines who are already there in that theater, right? Now, who's going? Who's being shipped out? This, from what I understand, is not a contingent of regular troops. This contingent that's being sent there is made up of almost entirely special forces. Special forces that are being sent to this area that will then primarily be members of the 75th Ranger Regiment out of Fort Benning, Georgia, as well as the Marine Expeditionary Units, who may be also the first to arrive. And they're going to be joined by members of the Navy SEAL team. They're also going to be joined by Delta Force and members of 82nd Air Force, as I reported to you over the weekend. By the way, the reason that we know this is because many of the men and the women in these units have said that they are being deployed. They've said it themselves. They've either told friends or told family members. And they're going to be joined by the Navy SEAL team members as well, who are going to be there coming to this place. Now, here's the question that needs to be asked at this point. If this were to happen, what is going to be the effect and where are they going to go? I got a map I want to show you about where this is going to happen. Let's put up the map, if we could, of the two areas where this is most likely to happen. Look at Karg Island. You see that up there? Because this is where things get a little fuzzy. But the thinking of most military analysts who have been speaking publicly on this issue is that the elite troops will somehow be dropped into the theater, likely right there at Karg Island, off the coast of Iran, and they're going to be dropped off there using low-flying aircraft, most likely helicopters, to seize Iran's oil. Now, let me show you another possibility. There's also thinking that they will actually use Qisem Island. You see that right there, Qisem Island? Analysts say that the troops will possibly go to Qisem Island, which is right near the Strait of Hormuz, and then they'll turn that into like an FOB, right, a forward operating base. You can see it right there on the map. It's that little strip of land right between the D in Qisem Island and the S in Strait of Hormuz. See that right there? That's Qisem Island. By the way, this place is considered one of the most beautiful places on Earth. So much so, it's been designated by UNESCO as a global heritage site because of its shoreline, cliffs and salt mines and historic 1,000-year-old sites. The population is roughly about, 100,000 people who live there. That's about to be taken over. Now, let me take you through the next part. What's the problem for the U.S. troops if they go in there? The problem is that Iran has been preparing for this attack for more than a decade, and they're said to have rocket launchers and drones that are hidden along the shoreline where the Persian Gulf is. In fact, you know, let's do this. Gene, put the map back up. I want to show him something. Put the map back up that we were just showing. Okay, so you see where Qisem Island is, and you see where Karg Island is. What do you see just above that? What is that along the shoreline? Those are mountains. You see those mountains? Those mountains are, according to reports, filled with hidden rockets, rocket launchers, drones, and everything that the Iranians have been hoping or thinking that they would have to use against some enemy at some point. And many of them are hiding underground for this exact purpose. Now, imagine being one of those Marines of the expeditionary unit who may be the first to go in, or the Rangers coming into this area, and you're being fired on from these rockets and drones that many of these guys don't have experience dealing with, like perhaps the Ukrainians do or the Russians do, since they've been in a drone warfare for some time. So it changes the game, and it makes people wonder what's going to happen. Is this too dangerous? Is this too risky, is what people are asking. As a matter of fact, I asked Scott Ritter about this the other day when he was right here, and I took him over to the map, and he shows us why he thinks that this is not going to turn out well for these elite forces being sent into Iran. Watch.
The ships come in this way, go right around that tip.
Right.
To come out, they have to come up, and they actually sail between two Iranian-controlled islands. That's the only exit channel. So you're going right between two islands where they have the missiles on them. See that coastline there?
Yeah.
Those are mountains. If you take a look at the videos, the ships go by, the mountains, everything's dug in right here. There's a brigade here called the RF Brigade, four battalions, that they're not ships. They have the missiles. They've been training for 20 years to defend this strait. We're going to come in with four amphibious ships.
Right.
All right? As they come in, they won't make it past here. They'll get sunk here. We knew this in 2019.
They'll get sunk here
because of the other missiles. And we knew this in 2019. The Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Berger, issued the Commandant's guidance. And he said, we can't fight this war anymore. We put all our Marines on one ship. And as we get close in, we're going to get sunk. So we're not even going to... This is the island they want to take.
Yeah.
The Marines aren't even going to get here before they all die.
I don't know. Maybe they were watching this report, because the understanding that I have now from some of the sources that I reached out to last night are that it's not going to be a Marine operation. In other words, they're not going to come in through sea. They're going to come in through air. Again, the expectation is, and none of this is confirmed, that they will come in with low-flying aircraft, helicopters, parachuting into these places to get the troops all in there at once. That's the desire. That's the hope. That's the expectation. Meanwhile, there's another part of this story which is important. The Israeli government is cheering Mr. Trump on and quite literally lecturing anyone who will criticize it at this point. This is kind of interesting. I want to show you something. This is the former Israeli prime minister. His name is Naftali Bennett. He convinces, some would say, frightens Americans into fighting for Israel, while at the same time criticizing Europeans for not thanking Israel enough for what it's doing for them. You got to watch this with your own eyes to actually believe what this guy's saying. Here, take a listen.
Had we not acted, all of Europe would be under a terrible nuclear ballistic missile menace. So we're fighting your war, and we expect not to be, criticized in and on, but we expect your backing. That would be the decent thing to do. I think any European leader who sort of says, this isn't our problem, so when will it become your problem? When they have a nuclear weapon? When the missile is on its way to Madrid, when it hits Madrid or Barcelona, is that when you're going to wake up? So we're doing the fighting. We didn't ask you for any help, nothing. All we're doing is fighting against this horrible radical Islamist menace. We're reducing and hopefully eliminating this threat. And instead of thanking us, you're criticizing us.
I like the way he says, we're doing the fighting. Maybe he has a pea in his pocket or something. Because last time I checked, it's the United States. It's the United States of America that's doing the fighting. It's the Americans who are doing the fighting in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, for Israel, while this clown sits there and says, we're doing all the fighting. That's just wrong, by the way. It's just wrong. He shouldn't say that. I think one of my favorite sayings one that I learned from my golf buddy and a guy who happens to be a Marine. His name is Mark Darrow, and he lives in Atlanta. When I used to work at CNN, we used to play golf on weekends. And it's probably the most appropriate thing you could say to somebody right here, and I'd say this to Mr. Bennett. Stop pissing on my leg and telling me it's raining. Stop pissing on my leg and telling me it's raining, because that's what he's doing. By the way, Mr. Bennett, that guy you just saw right there, the Israeli former prime minister, that's the same guy who recently suggested that right after the U.S. troops are done in Iran, Israel will then instruct them to go into Turkey. He said it. You remember, I played it for you about 3 weeks ago. Yeah, he actually said, Turkey is next. I mean, anyway. So all of this seems to be coming to a boil. And joining me live, as promised, is Jiangchu Qing. He is a Chinese educator who happens to be, by the way, and I think this is really important, known as the Nostradamus of China, because he's really good at making predictions, has made predictions many, many times, has his own YouTube channel, and is followed by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. By the way, he was just on with my friend Tucker Carlson and gave a great interview. Mr. Jiang, thanks so much for joining us, sir.
Thanks for inviting me, Rick.
So, I guess I need to ask you first and foremost how you would predict this assault this weekend that seems to be forthcoming. How do you think this would turn out if it actually takes place?
Well, as you laid out, every military analyst will tell you a ground invasion of Iran with only a few thousand Marines and possibly a few thousand airborne soldiers, Rangers, will be a disaster. Unfortunately, Donald Trump is a reality television star. And so what he's interested in is not strategy, but optics. Mm. He wants to create a narrative that the Americans are winning this war. Because right now, the whole world thinks that America is losing this war. So he wants to, with one knockout punch, basically decapitate the Iranian regime. And so I don't think he's interested in a long, drawn-out ground invasion, which could take months or years. He's hoping to settle this over the weekend, which is what happened with Venezuela, right? Remember, January 3rd, Delta Force swept into Caracas and abducted Maduro, and the war was over in only a few hours. So in Trump's mind, he believes that if he can pull off another great television spectacle, this war will be over, and then he can be the winner of this war.
Well, I'm hoping that my Chevrolet becomes a Rolls Royce, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen. So obviously my question to you is, that's what he hopes will happen. What do you think is more likely to happen after this assault this weekend?
So right now, we don't know how this assault will take place. But we have to remember that the U.S. military is very deadly and very efficient with these quick strikes. So we're going to imagine that if it happens this weekend, there will be air bombardment of the coast to knock out Iranian air defenses. Mm. And then the Marines and the 82nd Airborne Division will swoop into place. Now, analysts believe that they are talking to either Karg Island or, as you mentioned, Qassim Island, or maybe even a naval base near the coastline. But it's entirely possible that they would target all three all at once. It would be a multi-vector assault, mm-hmm. almost like D-Day, because that very much is what Trump wants. He wants fireworks. He wants good television. He wants to control the narrative.
Yeah. But if he tries to control the narrative by maybe landing people on those beachheads, I was listening to you when you were explaining to Tucker during your interview with him that in many ways, this is the way Vietnam started. First, you go in just to do a wrap-up, and before you know it, the whole thing gets out of control, and now you've got a hornet's nest that's been disturbed. Is that right?
Right. So, the great fear is that Trump is actually using this first strike in order to rally public opinion to just justify an actual draft and a full-scale ground invasion of Iran. So right now, Trump does not have the public support and the congressional approval for a full-scale ground invasion. So most experts believe you need at least 500,000 troops to invade Iran. There's no way he's getting 500,000 troops. There's no way he's getting $200 billion in congressional funding for this war. So he basically needs to create a narrative, an excuse, maybe a false flag to rally American sentiment, right? So if the Marines go in, and there are two possibilities, either they take Karg Island and they're very successful, in which case everyone believes that this war can be won, or the Marines get slaughtered, in which case American patriotism takes over and they want revenge for what happened. So I think that is really the play. Not that they think that this first strike will decapitate the regime or force a surrender. What they're really trying to do is draw America into a long war of attrition with Iran.
So you and I are just talking about what the United States wants to do. Now let me ask you from the other side. Let's look at it as if we were Iran. Iran is going to say, as soon as we know that you're doing this, yes, we're going to attack you. But beyond attacking you, we're going to do everything possible. You think the Strait of Hormuz is closed now? Wait till you see what we're going to do to make sure it's going to be closed for a long time as a result of what you're doing now. And we're going to hit the desalination plants in all of the GCC, or as the Iranians want to call it, the PGCC countries. This is just going to be a potential disaster zone to hear them tell it. What do you make of that description that they seem to be threatening us with?
Well, I mean, the reality is that America right now is in a quagmire in Iran. America doesn't really have good military options because right now Iran is holding the global economy hostage. As you point out, Iran has a lot of strategic flexibility, right? It can choose to mine the Strait of Hormuz, completely close off the Strait of Hormuz. It has not done so yet. And it can choose to target the GCC countries, their energy infrastructure, and their desalination plants. So the great fear among the Americans is that the price of oil shoots up to $200 a barrel, which would just devastate the global economy, which would turn public opinion in the United States and around the world against Trump. So Trump is really desperate right now. At the same time, he's surrounded by advisors, people like Peter Hegseth, Marco Rubio, Jared Kushner, Steve Witkoff, who are war hawks. They've been lying to him all this time. And so they will encourage him and make him believe that a quick strike will resolve a lot of issues. Trump knows he's in a desperate situation, and so he's going to make a desperate play. Even though, as you point out, it will probably not work out, and it doesn't make any strategic sense.
Let me show you something that you were just talking about. This is the leader of the Philippines declaring a state of emergency because his country is running out of fuel. Take this, Gene. I think it's cut three.
It's an emergency of the energy sector, the supply of energy, and the prices of energy.
President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. saying we're declaring a state of emergency in the Philippines. I'm hearing similar situations in Thailand, in Vietnam. What does this portend? What does this portend, Jang?
Sorry, Rick, but I hate to break the news, but this is COVID 2.0. Southeast Asia, India, Japan, South Korea, all these places are going to have to go into energy lockdowns. They're going to have to do work from home. They're going to have to ration gas. This is the reality because the world economy was built to be efficient, not resilient. For many years, people became addicted to access to cheap energy. And even if there were a ceasefire announced tomorrow, experts say it's going to take a few more weeks, maybe even many more months before the GCC can restore energy production to a level before this war started out. So the world economy is in a really bad place, and especially places like Southeast Asia, especially Thailand, Vietnam, Philippines, they should brace for the worst case scenario.
And so what I'm hearing you say, and I think we should probably go through this again, I want to make sure that I'm hearing you correctly. You're saying we're already at a point of almost no return, And if this thing escalates to the point where what we just described that could happen this weekend really blows up by both sides, we will be at a point of no return for the global economy. Is that what you're saying?
Right. That's exactly what I'm saying. And Southeast Asia is really the canary in the coal mine, because Southeast Asia, India and Japan and China get a lot of its oil from the GCC. It gets most of its oil from the GCC. So we should see the pain first take place in Thailand, Vietnam, the Philippines, and then it's going to cascade across the world.
Now, you predict things and you look at the future, and I think the way you're describing the future is that we will all live in a world where we're just going to have to get used to this. And you're not talking about 6 months down the road. You're talking about the future of the planet is that we're literally going to be in almost a new normal situation as a result of what we're seeing taking place in the Gulf. I think that's kind of what I heard you say the other day. Is that correct? And if not, please clear it up.
Right. So my argument is that the unipolar moment when America hegemony was dominant throughout the world, that was really unsustainable. It created the world that we live in for the past 20 years, when it was really cheap to fly around the world, when you could go to a supermarket and have any food from around the world all four seasons, when any middle-class individual could live the lifestyle of a Roman emperor. So we've been extremely blessed these past 20, 30 years in the American unipolar moment. But it was not sustainable because it relied on the exploitation of certain areas of the world, mainly the developing world. And it created a lot of corruption and inequality. And it strained the global resources. And so we're seeing a collapse of this unipolar moment. And now nations have to adapt to a multipolar world. And that often means, I think, a focus on deindustrialization, where they move people from the cities, which are energy dependent, they depend on energy imports, and back to the countryside to focus more on agricultural work.
Let's talk about this region by region and country by country, because I want to get your take on what's going to happen. So let's start like right at the heart of the situation, and that is Iran itself. What do you think will come of Iran as a result of this conflict, where they seem, according to most military experts I talk to be either winning or at least in a draw right now with the United States? But what happens to Iran long term after this?
I happen to believe that Iran is winning this war strategically, meaning that they have certain military objectives going into this war, and they have achieved all these military objectives, including controlling the Strait of Hormuz and forcing nations to pay tolls in order to access the Strait of Hormuz, including threatening the GCC nations to the point where Qatar and Oman are now siding with the Iranians, destroying American military bases throughout the Middle East, containing and disciplining and basically teaching Israel a lesson. So in terms of strategic objectives, Iran is doing a wonderful job. But the reality is that Iran is still up against two military superpowers, America and Israel, and they are destroying the nation. And we can expect that as Israel and America continue to lose this war strategically, they will become more desperate, meaning that they will target strategically Iran's civilian infrastructure, power plants, reservoirs, to make life very difficult for the Iranians. So we should expect massive destruction in Iran as this war continues. And much of the population will face tremendous hardship. At the same time, what this war is doing is rallying the patriotism, national pride of the Iranian people. It is unifying the people. And also, regardless of what happens, the Iranians are going to maintain control over the Strait of Hormuz. And that is a major maritime choke point that will allow Iran to generate billions of dollars in revenues every year.
Aren't they?
And at the end of...
Go ahead. Finish, please. I'm sorry. I thought you were done. Please finish your point. And I think we may have lost, but he'll probably come back. Let's hold on. Yeah. Go ahead, Jang, finish. You're back.
Yeah. So we also have to remember that Russia and China are strong allies of Iran. So Iran is a pivot point for Russia's North-South corridor, and Iran is also a pivot point for China's One Belt and Road Initiative. Hmm. So it is in the best interest to help Iran rebuild as soon as possible once this war is over. So with the financial and industrial assistance of China and Russia, and with the control of Strait of Hormuz, then we can expect Iran to come back much more powerful than before. In many ways, Iran will come out a major winner of this war.
Wow. In the long run. In the long run.
In the long run, yes. Yeah.
Then let's move to the other GCC countries. Let's talk about UAE and Oman and Saudi Arabia and all of the Kuwait and all of these Qatar and all of these countries. What happens to them? They must feel, right, like they were promised protection, but they haven't really gotten it. And I talk to my sources in these countries, and I get a sense they're very concerned for their own future right now. What happens in that part of the world?
Right. So you could argue that GCC is really the main pivot of the American empire, meaning that the GCC sold its oil in petrodollars, making the U.S. dollar the global reserve currency. And then it would take its profits and then recycle it back into the American economy, mainly into the stock market, mainly into AI investment. And right now, most of the American economy is run on AI investment. So if the GCC were forced to withdraw its investments from America and focus more on its own national development and national defense, then America would suffer economically tremendously. The GCC long-term has a lot of issues. It doesn't really have a military defense strategy. It was too reliant on the Americans. So once the Americans leave the scene, then these GCC nations will have to either depend on Israel or Iran for protection. Maybe nations like Qatar and Oman will choose to side with the Iranians. Saudi Arabia, UAE will side with the Israelis. But the future for the GCC is not optimistic because, remember, for the longest time, they were a mirage, meaning that they were not economically viable entities. They didn't have access to fresh water. They didn't have access to agriculture. And they didn't have that much human capital. They were entirely reliant on expatriates for expertise. And now that this mirage has shattered, these expatriates are going to go home. And they're going to have to spend a lot of their resources on defense. And so long-term prospects for the GCC is very, very bad.
Who are the biggest winners in all of this? Not just now, but looking forward maybe a few years as this thing continues to develop?
Well, the two biggest winners right now in the long term are Israel and Russia. Israel, once America leaves, CENTCOM will be absorbed into Israel. So all these military bases, all this air supremacy the Americans have will be absorbed into Israel. Once America leaves, then Israel will automatically achieve its Greater Israel Project because it will be able to control the GCC. And this has been a long-term ambition of the Israelis for many decades, especially these religious fanatics that now control the Israeli state. Also, we have to remember that Israel has always been the strategic hub and pivot of global trade. It will continue to be so even after this war is over. So expect Israel to thrive and flourish after this war is done as global investment goes to Israel in order to rebuild the Middle East and create the Greater Israel Project.
Can I just stop
Russia
you there? Can I just
stop?
Israel? Because there are people watching us. Obviously, we have tens of millions, if not 30 million viewers are going to be watching you say that. And they're thinking in their mind, is there, yeah, but can they achieve that while they admit themselves, because I've talked to Israeli officials who say, we understand that right now we're the most hated people in the world. Can they achieve that despite the antagonism, the global antagonism against this very small country?
Right. So that's a very good point. So after this war, I expect that Israel and Iran will come to a trade deal, come to an agreement. And then what's going to happen is that after this war is over, anti-Semitism is going to rage across the world because Americans will rightly believe that Israel was responsible for the downfall of the American empire. So you have not just Jewish talent returning to Israel, but also a lot of global capital going to Israel. Also, from the Israeli perspective, they really don't care if the world hates them because they have Mossad. Mossad is very good at infiltrating and subverting resistance movements. And so if anyone opposes them, then Mossad will take care of them. And that is what they believe they must do, because in the Jewish eschatology, in the fanatical Jewish understanding of things, they believe that the world will always hate them. And so they need to prepare for the day when the world unites against them. So unfortunately, you have these fanatics in power who are very fatalistic and who actually believe that anti-Semitism, the growth of anti-Semitism, the growth of global hatred against Israel, it will actually benefit Israel in the long term because it will unify the Jewish people and make them more reliant on God. The Jewish people will learn redemption and repentance, and this will allow God, Yahweh, their God, to support them in the final war between Israel and the world.
Oh, that's disheartening to hear you even say it. You mentioned two countries. You describe Israel's situation. You said there was a second country that was the real winner in all of this. Who's that?
Well, Russia is really benefiting from this war because as Iran attacks the global economy, the United States has no choice but to reduce sanctions on Russian oil. So the Russian economy will benefit tremendously from this war. Also, with the United States out of the Middle East, we can expect the United States to be forced out of the Middle East as this war drags on. Then Russia and Iran can build a closer trade relationship, establishing the North-South corridor, which will then allow Russia to access Africa, the Middle East, and Asia through Iran. And Russia will eventually win this war in Ukraine. Russia won this war 2 years ago. I don't understand why the Ukrainians are still resisting. But once this war is over, Russia will have control over one-third of the world's carbohydrates. And most of this food will be destined for the Middle East and Africa.
What about, I'm just curious, the United States relationship with Russia? It's like on again, off again. It was horrible during Biden, bad during Obama, kind of neutral during Trump. And there seems to be out there this glimmer of hope that somehow the Russians and the Americans will finally be able to pull it back together. Do you see that in the foreseeable future?
So right now, there's a civil war in Washington, D.C. between those globalists, Atlanticists, who have a racist hatred of Russia. For whatever reason, they believe that Russia is demonic and they must destroy Russia. And so these people will always hate Russia. But now you have a new group of people, MAGA, America First, people like Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, who believe that Europe, Asia is not in the American best interest. America should just focus on the Western Hemisphere. And these people are perfectly happy to come to terms with Russia. I believe strongly that at the end of the day, America First, MAGA, will win the foreign policy debate. And eventually, America and Russia will come to terms.
A year, 2 years, somewhere down the road, any sense of time on that?
We are looking at the earliest, maybe 10 years. And the reason why is that this transatlantic alliance between these people who hate Russia in Europe and America, they're intent on sending NATO into Ukraine to fight Russia. So Europe will call up a draft eventually, and then they will mass a conscription army to fight against Russia in the trenches of Ukraine. I think this is suicidal. I think this is kind of productive. I think that ultimately this will destroy Europe. But for whatever reason, NATO is committed to a final battle with Russia in Ukraine.
What is that reason? Why would they want to do that? You're right. It sounds suicidal.
Well, there are lots of reasons we could look at. One possibility is this ingrained hatred of anything Russian in the European psyche. That goes back to the Cold War, and maybe even before then. But there's a deep-seated irrational hatred of Russia among the European elite. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that there's a sunk cost fallacy in that Europe has invested too much resources into this war in Ukraine. It's like a gambler in a casino who's lost a lot of money and who cannot leave the casino because he doesn't want to go home and be cursed at by his wife for the rest of his life, right? So they're kind of stuck, sunk cost fallacy. Another reason is that internally, Europe is suffering a lot of issues. It faces the possibility of economic collapse because it lost access to cheap Russian energy. It's also possible you have a civil war in Europe because you have millions of these Muslim migrants who've come into the country and the local population feel threatened. And so there's this right-wing backlash in Europe. So maybe to avert a civil war, maybe it's better off to send these men to die in the trenches of Ukraine.
Wow. Okay, another country that is the West is often antagonistic to is China. You obviously know a lot about China. Let me show you some headlines I've been looking at in just the last couple of days that I had our team pull for you. These are headlines that mostly are being generated from the West. There's the Wall Street Journal. Trump's ambivalence on Taiwan opens a historic opportunity for China. Taiwan is wary of China exploiting the Iran war. PLA vows stronger combat readiness against Taiwan. So you see what the message is here, right? All these articles that are coming out of the West is it's just a matter of time now. Any moment now, China's going to invade Taiwan and take it over. And we all need to be very concerned. And Trump is dropping the ball. He's using all our forces over here, but he should be looking over there. That's kind of the message that's coming out of that. What do you make of that message, and what is the truth?
Well, I think before, the possibility of an invasion of Taiwan was very low. And now, because of what's happening in Iran, that possibility has almost gone to zero. So let me explain my reasoning. First of all, China is very dependent on oil from the GCC. The GCC provides 40% of oil for China. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have access to this oil, how are you going to fight a war, right? You're better off just maintaining your economy. That's number one. Number two is this war has shown the possibilities of asymmetric warfare where, you know, the United States had super carriers, Abraham Lincoln, Gerald Ford. It had the world's best air defense. Mm-hmm. It had the best jet fighter planes, like the F-35. And all of this technology, all of like these big weapon systems are proving futile against a dogged resistance among the Iranian people.
Yeah.
And so does China also want to find itself in a similar situation in Taiwan? And also what we're seeing is that this humiliation of the American military in Iran is going to have global consequences, meaning this is really the end of the American empire. It's really punctured the aura of inevitability and invincibility on which the American empire really rested. Right? People now understand how to fight the American empire, and the American empire is a paper tiger. So China doesn't want to take this risk with Taiwan as well, especially with a emergent Japan, okay? And the third thing is that this war in the Middle East, it's going to make North Korea, South Korea, and Japan much more militaristic, much more nationalistic, because they recognize that America can no longer protect global peace. And so they need to rearm as soon as possible in order to defend their trade routes. And so I think that as a Chinese strategist, I would look more at Japan than I would look at Taiwan.
Really? Well, you know, I've mentioned this on this newscast a couple of times, that I've been watching the THAAD missile system. It's supposed to be the most incredible and sophisticated system in the world. It's not. Same as the Patriot system. I talked to Ted Postol, and he came on my show and said that these two systems together are only knocking down maybe 5% of the rockets and the missiles coming in. I'm thinking, if I'm Japan or if I'm South Korea, I'm watching this and I'm saying, wait a minute, these are the systems you told us that you've put in our country so we can defend ourselves. If they're not working there, they're not going to work for us. That might be impetus for them to go out and say, the hell with it, we're going to defend ourselves, right? How far do they go, though? Do they go as far as ballistic missiles? Do they even go as, heaven forbid, nukes?
Right. So I think if you're Japan, your main focus is on reasserting naval supremacy in the South China Sea.
Yeah.
The reason why is that Japan is entirely dependent on imports for its resources, especially oil and food. And so it needs to protect these trade routes. And so you will see much more aggression among the Japanese in the South China Sea, especially around the Strait of Malacca, especially around the Strait of Taiwan. The South Koreans, North Koreans will also recognize that they need to remilitarize as soon as possible in order to access resources.
I asked you about the bond between, or the potential bond between, Russia and the United States. Let's talk for a minute about this bond between China and Russia all of a sudden, which seemed to me, anyway, when I went to cover the Shanghai summit, I got a sense that it's getting stronger with each passing year, that there is even a special relationship between Mr. Putin and Mr. Xi, and that these two countries together, between their resources, the hydrocarbons of Russia, for example, the skill set technologically of the Chinese, the population of the, in other words, when you put this puzzle together, it's a formidable operation between these two countries. It seems to me, but you know, I'm not you, and you know a lot more about this. I'm wondering what you think of this this alliance and what it bodes for the future.
I think this alliance between Russia and China would be great for both countries. And already we're seeing, you know, millions of Russians coming to China for vacation to establish partnerships. And so this is fantastic for both countries. The problem is that Chinese policymakers tend to be on the realpolitik, the realism school of geopolitics, meaning that they really don't see it's in the best interest of China to rely solely on Russia. Because as this war in the Middle East develops, then China will rely more and more on Russian energy. And from a Chinese geopolitical perspective, that can be dangerous in the long term because it's possible that Russian energy itself takes a hit, right? So if you're China, your immediate response to this war in the Middle East is to establish as many energy trading partners as possible. And unfortunately, that means you have to negotiate with Americans because North America can possibly be a major supplier of energy to China in the future. So I expect that when Donald Trump does come to China in mid-May, then I think that one thing they will discuss is the United States selling North American energy to China.
Will a U.S. president finally come along who will understand that the hegemony has either come to an end or must come to an end? The chest thumping, you know, American exceptionalism and all that, when the rest of the world is looking at it and saying, yeah, America's, I mean, I'm American. It's an incredible country with an incredible economy and incredible resources. But it's no longer the only incredible country, that there are coalitions of other countries that it's going to have to learn to either compete with or deal with. And my fear is that every president comes in and does just the opposite, buries us further into hegemony, which I don't think is positive, but maybe I'm wrong. What do you think?
Look, I completely agree with you in that if a U.S. president were to learn to work with other countries, especially China, Russia, and Iran, the world would be a much better place. The world benefits more from trading with each other than funding each other. Unfortunately, there are some structural issues in America that cannot be addressed in the short term. The first major structural issue is the dominance of the military-industrial complex that thrives on international conflict, right? So, like, this war, even though America's losing this war, they will still generate billions in profits. Yeah. And that's just how the military-industrial complex works. That's problem number one.
Yeah.
Problem number two is that, unfortunately, America is controlled by the baby boomer generation. And the baby boomer generation are used to the unipolar world. They think that it is their birthright to have the unipolar world. And so they cannot possibly accept America in decline. And so if you just look at polling, most Americans are against this war, but baby boomers are actually more supportive of this war than other generations. And I think that's because the baby boomers don't really can't really face any consequences. If America loses this war, not a big deal. If America wins this war, then they can still vacation in the Mediterranean and feel good about themselves, okay? So the baby boomers are a huge problem. And honestly, they're not dying. They'll probably live to 100 on average. And the third issue is just the mentality of America's foreign policy elite, where both Democrats and Republicans believe that America has the right to empire. America makes the world a better place. If America were to lose the empire, then the world would go into the garbage can. And so they are determined to maintain hegemony. And this is a consensus among all Washington elite.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think it's a dangerous consensus that leads us in the wrong direction. Let me finish up with a couple of quick things. First of all, you're Canadian, which is really interesting because Canada is a country that I don't think gets as much attention as it needs. But it's part of the Americas. When we think of America, we always think of the United States. But the Americas is Canada. The Americans is the United States. The Americas, Mexico. The United States is Cuba, the place where I was born. It's that whole, those two continents, essentially. Where does the rest of the Americas fall into, especially a place like Canada, for example, in the future, in its relationship with the rest of the world? And, of course, its relationship with the hegemony itself, the United States and Washington, D.C.
Well, as a Canadian who follows Canadian politics, I have to say this, Rick, but Canada does not have a future. The Trudeau administration and now the Carney administration are really destroying Canada. Hmm. They have chosen easy, politically correct policies and ignore the best interests of the Canadian people. So these past 5-6 years, they've let in millions of immigrants. And this is causing the housing market to explode, meaning Canadians can no longer afford to buy a house. Canadians can no longer find a decent job. Standard of living has gone way up in Canada. Then you have the COVID policies that really destroyed the energy and optimism of the Canadian people. You know, there were these trucker protests in Ottawa during the COVID lockdowns. And all they wanted was for their voice to be heard. And the Trudeau administration responded by debanking all the truckers and all those who supported their right to protest. Hmm. So Canada has become extremely authoritarian these past few years, especially after the COVID lockdowns. And now what Carney seems to be doing is asset stripping Canada, meaning that he's trying to sell Canadian land, Canadian resources to the Qataris, to the Chinese, to the Americans before Canada itself goes bust. So Canada does not have a viable future. It will probably be absorbed in the United States at some point.
So finally, this is amazing. You're expanding my brain listening to you with all these areas of the world that you've broken down for us. Let's finish with what we have at hand, this situation where, once again, the United States is asserting itself in the Middle East. And one can't help but wonder, what is your final fine point as a futurist that we need to understand about this moment that we're living in right now that we will all look back on maybe 3, 4, 5 years from now and say, that's when things changed? And what will that change be?
Well, Mark Carney used the word during his World Economic Forum speech, yeah, way back in January, he used the word rupture. And so we are living in the world of rupture, where old institutions, old systems of belief are going to break down. And not only our values and institutions are going to break down, but nation states are going to break down as well. The global economy will collapse at some point, and nations will go into revolutions, political instability, civil war. So this will be a time of tribulation, of chaos. But at the same time, it will also be a time of spiritual awakening, in that more and more people will discover and think to themselves, what gives me meaning and purpose in life? Am I just a consumer, or am I a human being? And so I think that you will see a massive growth in religion. You will see a massive resurgence in spirituality. So this will mark a turning point in human history. And looking back maybe 100 years from now, maybe historians will think this was a good thing, because before we were too consumeristic, we were too individualistic, we were too selfish and greedy. And this has led us to a time of massive depression and massive unhappiness. And so maybe this rupture is a divine sign that enables us to fully engage in self-reflection and discover what brings us happiness and meaning in our lives.
Jiang Zhuqing, predictor, futurist, historian. It's an amazing conversation to be able to watch you capture all of these issues and show us not only where we are, but kind of where we've been and also where we're going. Do me a favor, let people know where they can find you, because I think people will watch you here and say, I want to hear this guy some more. Where can people find you if they want to listen to some of the things that you speak of?
Right. So the best place to find me is on YouTube. So I'm a teacher in Beijing, and I upload my lectures to YouTube on history, on geopolitics, on game theory. And so if you go to Predictive History YouTube, then you will find my lectures.
Thanks so much. You've been so kind to give us so much of your time, and you're such a smart guy. Thanks, really.
Thanks,
I really appreciate you coming on. And I know our viewers appreciate it as well. Thank you. Well, as always, we appreciate all the feedback, and we want to tell you that much of what you see here, we're going to be posting. So you're going to be able to see it on BitChute, which we now have an association with. You're going to be able to see it on X. You're going to be able to comment. You're going to be able to listen to it and take me for a jog on Spotify. I love to go jogging with podcasts, not my own. But anyway, most importantly, thanks so much for being with us. And thank you for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.